morning.
Good morning, good morning. Please be seated. Let our record reflect that Chief Justice Pickering is with us at the Regional Justice Center in Las Vegas. But because this falls within a prior panel assignment, I have the pleasure of presiding over the proceedings here today. The first case before us is Rock Bay LLC versus the District Court, Redwood Recovery Services LLC is a real party of interest. We have Mr. Hung and Mr. Rose. Mr. Hung, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, and may it please the Court, Eric Hone on behalf of petitioners Mayborn Incorporated and Rock Bay LLC. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. More than any other fact or legal issue the parties have briefed on this writ, the one issue that weighs most heavily on the question before the Court is the fact that at no point in time during these proceedings or on this writ have the real parties in interest, the respondents, claimed that the non-party petitioners are in any way responsible for the debt of the judgment debtors. They have not alleged that they are entitled to recover from Mayborn or Rock Bay. They have not alleged any theory of liability for the debt of the judgment debtors. They have not alleged a fraudulent transfer between the judgment debtors and the petitioners. They have not alleged a failure to maintain corporate formalities between the judgment debtors and the petitioners. They haven't alleged any basis for recovery from the petitioners. And that reality must guide the Court's interpretation of Rule 69. Rule 69 governs post-judgment discovery, and it is the rule that applies to this case. And from this Court's perspective, Rule 69 can be the be-all and the end-all of its inquiry, because there is no authority and no case law interpreting Rule 69 in Nevada.
You wouldn't dispute, however, if the discovery sought was dealing with just financial records that relate to the business, if you will, the LLC, that they would be entitled to that.
We don't dispute that if it has anything to do with the assets of the judgment debtors, any debts owed by petitioners to the judgment debtors, and even business transactions between the judgment debtors and petitioners, that is fair game for discovery. And in fact, the district court originally, when we were at the district court, there were three non-party entities involved in the motions to quash the subpoena to the accounting firm. And when the district court judge ruled in that instance with regard to Sloan Park, actually entered the order that I think would have been the proper order for the other two parties, which is, insofar as there are transactions that would show distributions between the two, financial transactions between the two, or debts owed to the judgment debtors, they have to be disclosed. And we agree with that. But in fact, I think that gets to the core of the limiting aspect of Rule 69. Specifically, has a limiting clause. And that clause is in the middle of the rule that says, in aid of the judgment or execution. And that is the limiting requirement in the rule that limits discovery to only those inquiries that will discover assets that will allow the judgment to be satisfied, and that is the governing rule in the case. Now, there are a few authorities in other jurisdictions that we referred to. I think the most relevant is the Falacia case out of the district court in D.C., and that court set out a three-step analysis, and it referred to the parties being closely related, there being money transfers, and there being doubts about the legitimacy of those transfers. And in that case, the court allowed discovery in a situation where the judgment debtor, after getting the judgment against it, simply transferred its contracts, both to receive money and do work, to a successor interest. And in fact, the court in Falacia said, it's not that we're dealing with a non-party. In fact, the company that was trying to quash the subpoena was in fact a successor interest. But in this case, the reality is much different. What has been asked for in this circumstance is not just transactions and financial dealings between judgment debtors and the non-party petitioners. It's the entirety of their tax and financial dealings in the possession of their accountants and U.S. Bank. It goes well beyond what the proper scope under 69 should be, which is what will aid in the recovery, what are the assets of the judgment debtor that you non-party petitioners have. Now, the only basis that the judgment creditor, real parties in interest, have alleged is that there's a close relationship. And we have never disputed that there is a close relationship between the petitioners and the judgment debtors. It's explained in the Florida judgments that underlie this debt. It's explained in the declarations of Jeffrey Kirsch and William Hershkowitz in the record that explain that the ARE entities and Mr. Kirsch do dealings with multiple, dozens and dozens of investors from foreign countries who come in, he packages the underperforming mortgages, they buy them, and they ultimately sell them. The judgment creditors are simply one of dozens and dozens of companies who have done business with Mr. Kirsch in this fashion. And Rock Bay and Mayborn are management and rollover entities who deal with dozens and dozens of other investors of ARE and Mr. Kirsch. And simply because there's a relationship that is not denied is not enough to get over to the point where you have to disclose all of your financial records without any reason to indicate that there's an ability to collect upon for the judgment debt.
But does the subpoena really go that far? Is it really a blanket subpoena?
Yes, it is. And in fact, there's two subpoenas. There's one to McNair & Associates, which is the accounting firm that did work for Mayborn and for Rock Bay, and there are 27 categories of documents where if you go through it, and there's subparts to those, so it's actually more than 27 requests. They ask for everything, et cetera, that McNair has in its possession to be turned over. Now, with U.S. Bank, there are about 10 requests, but they ask for every document, bank account, loan, anything that would indicate the financial status of Rock Bay. And then there's a catch-all provision at the end. The last request says, to the extent that you have any documents regarding Rock Bay that aren't covered by the prior requests, we want you to turn that over too. So it is all-encompassing. Now, what those documents, if they were turned over, would reveal is all of Rock Bay's dealings with its dozens and dozens of other investors and foreign individuals and private individuals who are rightfully doing business with Rock Bay. It would reveal their names. It would reveal their bank account information. It would reveal wire transfers that had been made to these private entities for business dealings that had nothing to do with the judgment debtors and in no way could be used to satisfy the judgment. The appropriate scope of the subpoena should be what I talked about before, which is what it was for Sloan Park. A Rule 69 appropriate order that allows for judgment in aid of collecting, for discovery in aid of collecting on the judgment, which would be any financial transactions, dealings, or debts between the judgment debtor and the non-party petitioners. That's the appropriate scope under Rule 69. If the court has no further questions, I thank you for your time.
Is Rock Bay in dissolution?
Pardon me?
Is Rock Bay in dissolution?
Rock Bay was originally formed in Delaware, and it was registered also in Nevada. The Nevada entity has been dissolved, but the Nevada registration postdated the registration in Delaware.
Not sure I followed that answer. Is the company in dissolution?
The company was dissolved, and I apologize if I was unclear. The company was dissolved in Nevada, but it was previously and continues to exist through its Delaware registration. Are there any further questions?
Has it distributed its assets to its shareholders?
No, it continues to operate its rollover entities as discussed in the declarations of Mr. Kirsch and Mr. Hershowitz. It continues to operate. It has been dissolved in Nevada, but it continues to operate, and it manages a number of investment pools for other investors, not the judgment creditors, but other investors who have invested in other pools of mortgages. It continues to operate. It continues to have money in it. It's account and pay out those funds to those investors to whom their monies are due.
For the real parties in interest that have been referred to in this case collectively as Redwood, I would like to spend my time highlighting three main areas. The first is the evidentiary findings of the district court that support the ruling that was made in the district court. Second is the rule or the test that was applied and that should govern in our case and in other cases as to post-judgment discovery. And then finally, to the extent I have time, I'd like to respond to some issues they've raised in their reply brief. Before I go through those, I just want to mention to the first point that Mr. Hohn began with. We don't have to allege and establish and prove a basis for responsibility. We already won. That is not the issue, and that is not an argument they raised below. We don't have to go show that Rock Bay and Mayborn signed the promissory notes at issue. That is not the case. So the opening statement, I believe, is not the direction that governs this case, and they don't cite cases to support that claim. The key issue here as far as the evidence is that Mr. Kirsch is an owner of American Residential Equities LLC, referred to as ARE. The reason that's so important because he dominates and controls its operations. Its operations include establishing a number of different LLCs, which include Rock Bay, Sloan Park, and Mayborn. So, and I think Mr. Hohn has conceded that, there's no dispute that all of the entities at issue here, the judgment debtors and every non-judgment debtor, is dominated and controlled and indeed established at the instance of Mr. Kirsch. I think that's the first key point. Second, we showed the tax returns that show that these non-judgment debtor entities are partners and pass-through entities of the judgment debtors. We've shown that Rock Bay shows up as a partner on 2010 tax returns and on 2009-2010 K-1s of ARE. Various ARE entities. We've shown that they share each other's debts, that ARE has paid debts and liabilities for Rock Bay. We established and produced checks of those payments. We showed the transfers, the money transfers to and from Rock Bay. Now, counsel in their briefing has said, well, there's a good reason for that, and as we pointed out in our brief, I won't go into it in detail here, but there certainly is reason to raise an eyebrow as to Mr. Kirsch's explanations. But even if you were to accept Mr. Kirsch's explanations, those transfers, continuous transfers back and forth between the judgment debtors and the non-judgment judgment debtors show that these entities are so intertwined and interconnected. They depend on each other. Their very business model has them married to each other. So there's no separateness. Another point that I would like to emphasize, because I don't know if it was as prominent in our briefing, all of the operations of the judgment debtors, which again includes establishing these non-judgment debtor LLCs, all of these operations were moved to a non-judgment debtor entity, Addle Hill. We cited the deposition of William Hershkowitz, the CFO from ARE, who testified that one day all operations were in ARE. The next day, January 1st, 2011, they were moved to a non-judgment debtor, Addle Hill. He didn't know why, but it was clear that all operations, all bank accounts, all employees ceased to function under ARE and began functioning under a non-judgment debtor entity. I think that's important because in the briefing below, in the briefing before this court, and in the argument now, we still have not heard any explanation for the tax returns, for the payments and sharing of debts and liabilities, and more importantly, for the complete transfer of the entire operation to a non-judgment entity. The final point is the dissolution of Rock Bay. We still have never heard a reason, and Judge Miley down below was very concerned about why we would domesticate our judgments in Nevada in December, and then only weeks later, Rock Bay would dissolve. That issue was never addressed in the district court. It is not addressed in the briefing here or in the argument. So the question in our mind is, if not now, then when? If we cannot obtain this discovery against these LLCs that are highly related and an integral part of the judgment debtors, then where would any judgment creditor be able to obtain discovery of a non-party entity? And that leads me to my second area, which is the legal standard that should govern. Counsel has referred in the briefing and again here about a three-part test, and I want to emphasize that there is not a single case that adopts or even discusses the proposed three-part test. And I think that's important because it's a test that shouldn't apply now. And counsel mentioned Felicia, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but Felicia doesn't talk about a three-part test. Discovery is not supposed to be harder once you obtain a judgment. It's hard enough to get a judgment. The standard for discovery doesn't become more onerous or burdensome after you obtain a judgment. In fact, it's the opposite. Rule 26 says that the parties can obtain discovery about the claims or defenses of any party. But Rule 69 goes further than that. Rule 69 says we can get discovery from any person, including the judgment debtor. Is it an accident that Rule 69 says we are allowed to obtain discovery from any person, as opposed to the Rule 6 standard about any party? I know that's not the case. So the test should be, and this is what the cases show, the test should be to obtain discovery from a non-judgment debtor third party. Is there some relationship between that entity or person and the judgment debtor that makes it reasonable under the circumstances to get the discovery that's requested? That should be the issue, and that's what Felicia says. Felicia, and I beg counsel to acknowledge that Felicia is the most relevant case, because I agree. Felicia involved a subpoena for banking records to Wachovia Bank. It involved a subpoena for banking records for two non-judgment debtor entities that were related to the judgment debtor. The court there found that these entities were mere extensions of the judgment debtor. They were formed on the day of the verdicts. The court said there's a colorable suspicion regarding the relationship, that the entities are still controlled by family members. No question that the court found in that case that discovery was reasonable under the circumstances.
Well, the test is a little narrower than that, counsel, under Felicia. And the test is whether there are reasonable doubts that have been raised concerning the good faith of transferred assets between the two entities. What facts were presented to the district court judge that addressed that the transfers between ARE and Rock Bay raise reasonable doubts as to the good faith nature of those transfers? I'm not sure the district judge examined that.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. The facts that were presented to the district court about the transfers were, one, the transfers between Rock Bay, which was an entity that was dissolved, and the judgment debtors. Two, and I think this is important because in the motion to reconsider, the petitioners presented no new evidence to the district court, but we presented substantial additional evidence. One is that all of the assets of the judgment debtor entities, ARE, which includes Rock Bay and Sloan Park and Mayborn, that those were all moved to a non-judgment debtor entity. The facts also emphasize the nature of the underlying judgments, which arose because of fraudulent transactions. And we claimed then, as we do now, that there was reason to doubt the affidavit of Mr. Kirsch. Mr. Kirsch's declaration was, these transfers are in the normal course of business. The court found that because of the transfers, because of the evidence we presented, that there's a commonality of ownership control, that assets were shared back and forth, and also the change of the operations to a non-judgment entity, the court looked at the totality of the circumstances, including the transfers.
But does the judgment encompass transfers from Rock Bay and to ARE and back again?
The underlying Florida judgments?
Yes, sir.
No, they did not, Your Honor. No.
So you're saying, well, the judgment compensated for these transfers, they didn't relate specifically to Rock Bay.
The judgment showed that the scheme could be questioned and that Mr. Kirsch's explanations about the transfers as being part of the normal course of business were suspicious. She
calls
found
him to, calls him to doubt these transfers.
She found his affidavit to be self-serving, especially given the findings of fraud in the Florida judgment. And so the totality of the circumstances, Your Honor, is what the judge focused on, including the transfers to and from Rock Bay, the sharing of assets and liabilities between ARE, Rock Bay. And I will mention that Felicia does mention that two-part test about the transfers and the reasonable doubts of transfers. But I believe Felicia mentioned that in the context of referencing the prior Borak case, which is from the same district. And I think what Felicia was doing was acknowledging that that 1939 case of Borak had set forth that two-part test. But Felicia didn't limit the consideration of factors just to those two instances. Felicia said you can look at everything to see if there is a basis for the discovery. I do want to address the confidentiality issue because Felicia addressed that as well. There's not a single case that the petitioners have cited that uphold or even address a confidentiality claim in the context of judgment debtor discovery. Now, there is one case that discusses that, and it's Felicia. And Felicia says, you can't raise that on vague confidentiality. You can't avoid judgment discovery without showing what the irreparable harm is going to be by disclosure of these documents. And there has been no showing of irreparable harm in this case. There have been strenuous claims that disclosure of these documents would cause harm to the entities or to the third-party investors, but there's been no showing of that. And as an example, if I were to invest $1,000 in one of these entities, these subpoenas are not going to reach my personal bank account statements. They're not going to reach my personal financial statements, my personal tax returns. We are seeking, and the subpoenas are aimed at, the business records, the bank account records of these entities that are part and parcel of the judgment debtors. So I do want to acknowledge that.
And neither respondent is a competitor of Rock Bay. Is that right?
I'm sorry, Justice Hardesty?
And neither of the respondents are competitors of Rock Bay.
That is exactly right, Justice Hardesty, and that is a point that the Felicia Court also mentioned. I want to point out a few issues in the reply that they mentioned. The petitioners say, we only did business with the judgment debtors. There's no evidence we possess assets. You are the business of the judgment debtors. That's undisputed. You exist for the business operations of the judgment debtors. That's why you have transfers going back and forth. We believe you are the assets of the judgment debtors. You were established at their instance. You are controlled by them. So their point is not well taken. They also claim in their reply brief that the funds invested belong to the third-party investors, not to Rock Bay. Well, we know in part that that's true because that's how they ended up with $17 million of our money. But again, that doesn't give them blanket protection against their banking records, their information that is going to shed further light on the relationship that is incestuous at least.
According to the tax returns, who owns Rock Bay before the transfers from ARE to the other company?
I don't know who owns Rock Bay based on the tax returns. That is not entirely clear to me, and I don't know if it's entirely clear on the tax returns. Rock Bay is shown as a partner on the tax returns of ARE. So whether it's a wholly owned entity of ARE because it was established by it, I do not know that. Justice Hardesty.
Kirsch's declaration says he owns it.
Kirsch's declaration says, if I could conclude.
Of course.
Kirsch's declaration says he is a principal of ARE, the main judgment debtor, and that ARE establishes various LLCs to conduct its operations, which include Rockbourne and Rock Bay, Mayborn, and Sloan Park.
Do you understand that declaration to say that Kirsch owns Rock Bay by saying he's a principal?
It's not that explicit, but it's clear that Rock Bay was established at the instance of an entity, ARE, that Mr. Kirsch does own and controls.
Okay.
10 seconds, if I could, to...
You can make a concluding statement.
We don't believe the petitioners have shown that extraordinary relief in this case is warranted, that the district court abused its discretion, and we would ask that the relief requested be denied. Thank you.
Mr. Hearn, it looks like you have 5 minutes and 13 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Rock Bay is owned by the investors in the investment pools that were subsumed into Rock Bay. That's made clear in the declaration of Mr. Herskowitz and in the declaration of Mr. Kirsch. ARE is one of a little over half a dozen judgment debtors. ARE LLC, as is explained in the declarations, is the management company, and there's nothing nefarious about the fact that the management company, who goes out and finds investors around the world to invest in various management pools, actually is the one creating these various entities. There's no secret about that. And the fact that Jeff Kirsch and a handful of other officers with whom he works operate that, there's nothing nefarious about that and nothing questionable about that. But what we have not heard and what we did not hear from the real parties in interest is that there's anything other than the fact that they all operate under the direction and control of a businessman named Jeff Kirsch and some of his business partners, that there has been anything improper about the corporate form.
Well, counsel, part of the reasoning of the district court judge in the transcript was reference to money transfers, four of them, three before the judgment, one after. Why wouldn't those transfers fit, even if you accept that the Felicia case adds this narrowing component? Why wouldn't that be sufficient to allow discovery into the circumstances surrounding those transfers?
Actually, Your Honor, just to make sure that we're clear on that, we believe discovery as to those transfers is appropriate. And in fact, that should be the scope of the discovery that's permitted. What happened with those transfers? Why did they occur? Under what contractual basis? What was the reasoning for those? Discovery is appropriate as to those transfers.
Can you give me an example or two of the contents of the subpoena directed at Rock Bay that goes beyond that test?
Yes. I'll go to the U.S. Bank subpoena, which requests everything in U.S. Bank's possession related to Rock Bay, all their bank accounts, every statement,
every loan transaction, every wire they've made, every document that U.S. Bank has regarding the entire universe of Rock-based financial dealings with its owners, its investors, and other companies, the subpoena to U.S. Bank on behalf regarding Rock Bay asks for that entire universe of financial documents related to Rock Bay. It doesn't just ask for show us any records or documents that relate to debts that Rock Bay owes the judgment debtors. It doesn't say just show us the transactions between Rock Bay and the ARE entities or the other judgment debtors or any financial or business transactions you might be privy to. That's where Rule 69 would limit an appropriate scope of review. We're not saying there shouldn't be any inquiry into those transactions. Those transactions are fair game, but those
Can you give me an example out of the McNair subpoena that you think exceeds the scope?
The McNair subpoena is similar. It just relates primarily to, again, it asks for a financial record. It asks for tax returns and other accounting records, books of Rock Bay that might have been utilized in the preparation of the tax returns. So it's very similar to the U.S. Bank subpoena in that rather than just limiting it to monies due to the judgment debtors or assets of the judgment debtors or transactions, it would uncover the entirety of the universe of Rock Bay's dealings with its owners, who are separate investors and not judgment debtors, and every other dealing that they've had, rather than assets and transactions upon which they would be able to recover under Rule 69.
So that's what is the meaning of the reference in the Kirsch Declaration that he's a principal in Rock Bay? What does that mean?
He's a principal of ARE. He's a principal of ARE LLC. And ARE LLC is one of the judgment debtors. And ARE LLC went out and it found the investors, the four investors who invested in different investment pools. They were eventually rolled in together under Rock Bay. But Mr. Kirsch is not a principal of Rock Bay.
It's ARE?
ARE is not. Mayborn Inc. is the manager of Rock Bay LLC, but it is entirely owned by the investors. Is with Rock Bay, and that is explained in the declarations of Mr. Hershkowitz and in Mr. Kirsch that were provided to the Supreme Court, provided to the District Court.
And what declaration can you point me to or evidence that addresses the explanation for the transfer of Rock Bay's assets on January 1 or just prior to it?
Of Rock Bay's assets?
Mm-hmm. That's what I understood counsel to say.
So this is a clarification I couldn't make. The judgment debtors in ARE eventually transferred their assets to Addle Hill.
Mm-hmm.
That's a transaction that has nothing to do with Rock Bay. ARE and the judgment debtors, to the extent that they transfer assets to a new company called Addle Hill, has no bearing on this issue in Nevada because Rock Bay, and there's no allegation that Rock Bay had anything to do with that, and their assets weren't transferred in the Addle Hill transfer. That's in the record. There's been a lot of, I think, smoke and mirrors when it comes to transfers of assets, but that had nothing to do with Rock Bay.
One final question, Justice Scalia. Do you acknowledge that the tax returns reflect that Rock Bay and ARE are partners?
It reflects that ARE has a 0% partnership interest in Rock Bay. It's listed in, and this is this was actually explained in the Hershkowitz declaration on the U.S. Bank in the rehearing subpoena, that they were listed as a partner for tax filing purposes, but it very clearly indicates within that listing of the partnership that there were zero, that there's a 0% pay-in and pay-out. Essentially, ARE didn't put anything into Rock Bay, and it gets nothing in return. It's a 0%. It's a partner, but it has no take in the financial benefits of the company.
Mr. Goodwin, anything further? I will conclude not. Thank you all. This matter will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.
Thank you.